College Basketball Insider.
Some news and notes from around the world of college basketball.
In-studio correspondent for WFAN and CBS Sports Radio.
Attention, please, to John Rothstein. Please report to St. Joe's.
The Insider's Insider.
Joining us now with his thoughts and to break it down, John Rothstein.
It's College Hoops Today with John Rothstein.
Let's put the women and children to bed and go looking for dinner. John Rothstein here on the College Hoops Today podcast, coming to you 52 weeks out of the calendar year. Later in the show, we'll be joined by a personal friend of the podcast, Wally Zerbiak, in-studio analyst for the MSG Network in regards to the New York Knicks, also an in-studio analyst for CBS Sports College Basketball Coverage. Wants you to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and leave us a review. Let us know what you think of the product we're bringing to you 52 weeks out of the calendar year. Also, check out the College Hoops Today fan page on Facebook and leave us a like if you so choose. And also send me your questions. I'll get to them later in the podcast on Twitter. I'm at John Rothstein. That's John, J-O-N. And I want to let you know that we are brought to you by Harry's. Father's Day is right around the corner, and a Harry's shaving set will make the perfect Father's Day gift. It looks cool, it feels special, and it's something that Dad will actually use. Forget the tie or pair of socks he's never going to wear. Get him a gift to love. Thankfully, Harry's has got you covered. The limited edition Father's Day shave set includes a matte black razor handle, a chrome razor stand, Harry's moisturizing foaming shave gel, three of Harry's handcrafted blade cartridges, and a travel cover, all for just $40. Harry's also offers great shaving sets starting at $15. Get one for yourself, too. You get a great shave at a great price. Go to harrys.com right now and redeem a special offer for fans of the show. Harry's will give you $5 off your first purchase with promo code HOOPS. Don't wait. That's HARRYS.com. Enter code HOOPS at checkout to get $5 off. Get Dad something he'll actually use this Father's Day. And now that we've got you all set up with everything you need to know for your shaving needs and your Father's Day gifts, let's shift to basketball. And look, it is the time of the year right now where we start to focus intensely on the NBA draft on this podcast. And when you talk about the NBA draft in 2016, you have to talk about the debate at the top of the draft. Ben Simmons of LSU versus Brandon Ingram from Duke. Who should be the number one pick in the 2016 NBA draft? Who should the Philadelphia 76ers opt to put their faith in moving forward as potentially the future of this franchise? Now, I look and I try to split the atom in as many different ways as possible when I am trying to dictate what makes the most rational sense as to who is going to be worthy of being the number one pick in the NBA draft. Last year, from about February on, I was adamant about, and more than adamant, I should say, that Karl Anthony Towns should have been the top pick in the 2015 NBA draft ahead of Duke's Jahlil Okafor. And I'm really starting to feel that same way about Ben Simmons over Brandon Ingram. Because one thing that I look at, and I think it's imperative to do this, you have to look at the structure in which these players were set up during their 1 year of college basketball. Both Simmons and Ingram were only 1 year players at Duke and LSU respectively. So you look at Brandon Ingram, 6'9", 190 pounds, made over 80 threes, at times looked lethal as a stretch four. But the big difference between Brandon Ingram of Duke and Ben Simmons of LSU to me is Brandon Ingram is a potent offensive player, one that's going to be able to score the ball for an awful long time in the NBA. Ben Simmons is a transcendent type talent. And he is somebody who, in a lot of ways, became college basketball's version of LeBron James when you talk about what he had to go through in terms of being chastised on social media. Regardless of what Ben Simmons would do statistically, and he averaged 19 points, 12 rebounds, 5 assists while shooting 56% from the field, it wasn't enough. It wasn't enough that he constantly filled the box score at will. It wasn't enough that he was always seemed to be in situations where he was putting things together at a ridiculous rate. Now, why am I waiting this long to talk about LSU's win-loss record? It's really simple. Because I wrote last summer that the expectations for LSU were far too high entering last season. Because even though LSU added a player the caliber of Ben Simmons, it still lost two players, not one, two players that were drafted among the top 33 picks in last June's NBA draft, Jarrell Martin and Jordan Mickey. So even if Ben Simmons was coming to Baton Rouge, he was coming to Baton Rouge with a supporting cast that was somewhat unproven. Antonio Blakeney had never played, okay, a college game before last season. Craig Victor, the transfer from Arizona, wasn't eligible until December. And Keith Hornsby last season only played 20 games due to multiple injuries. And Keith Hornsby, you got to remember, was the only shooter and the only player on LSU's roster that shot over 40% from the field. And if you are a dominant player like Ben Simmons and you dominate the ball, and I'm not comparing him to LeBron James, but you dominate the ball and you need space to operate because he's not a great shooter, and I don't even know if he's ever going to be a great shooter. That's his Achilles heel. You need space to operate. You need the ability to create your own opportunities with the ball in your hands. That was difficult for Ben Simmons because he didn't have the shooting around him that somebody like Brandon Ingram did. Brandon Ingram played with multiple players that shot 40% or better from three. Grayson Allen and Matt Jones. Luke Kennard was also a double-figure scorer that Brandon Ingram played with, and he's a better shooter, in my opinion, than the 32% he showed from three-point range last year. But he's also the type of player that seems like he's always going downhill when he gets the ball. So my question is this. Ben Simmons, if he was switched with Brandon Ingram and was put on Duke and had the ability to play with a Matt Jones and play with a Grayson Allen and play with a Luke Kennard, I don't think there would be any discussion. I don't think there would even be any debate about who would be the top pick in the 2016 NBA draft. And here's another thing that I think gets dismissed because LSU didn't play in the NCAA tournament and opted not to play in the NIT last year. If LSU found a way to beat Kentucky at Rupp Arena, the last day of the regular season, the Tigers would have tied Kentucky for the SEC regular season title. And again, that's with Keith Hornsby playing 20 games, and that is with losing Jarrell Martin and Jordan Mickey from the prior season. And one thing you got to remember about a team like LSU and a program like LSU, even if you add a dominant talent like a Ben Simmons, you are not going to be in a situation where you can constantly replenish losing pros at that type of a rate because LSU is not Kentucky. There is not the culture in place that we see at Kentucky in terms of just reloading for the next season. And even though you're going to see a situation where Kentucky seems to always reload with one-and-done type players, John Calipari will also go out of his way to tell you how important it is to have returning players. And returning players, to me, and people need to remember this, were the key when Kentucky won a national championship in 2012. Now, did Kentucky have the 1-2 pick in that draft and Anthony Davis and Michael Kidd-Gilchrist? Absolutely. But Kentucky, the 2012 Kentucky team that won a national championship, had three players back from a team that played in a Final Four the year before. Deron Lamb, Darius Miller, and Terrence Jones. Returning players are far more critical in college basketball than incoming players. Regardless of what you want to say, it is very rare that you're going to have a team go deep in the NCAA tournament with just freshmen. Kentucky in 2014 caught lightning in a bottle with the Harrisons, with James Young, with Julius Randle. But here's what you have to remember. Kentucky entered the NCAA tournament that year as an 8 seed, beat Wichita State on the last possession, beat Louisville on the last possession, beat Michigan on the last possession, beat Wisconsin on the last possession, and then found a way somehow to play in the national championship game before they, you know, lost to UConn. Freshmen are always going to be freshmen. But even John Calipari's freshmen, Davis, Kidd-Gilchrist, had the luxury of playing with Lamb, with Miller, and also with a guy like Terrence Jones. And that's what my argument is with Ben Simmons and Brandon Ingram. Brandon Ingram is a terrific player, a terrific offensive player. But I remember this, you know, I was having a conversation with an NBA head coach probably 3 years ago. And we talked about, you know, what position are you going to be at the next level? How do you define who is going to play where? And he said, John, you are who you can guard. And if you are who you can guard in the NBA, when I look at Brandon Ingram, he's 6'9", 190. Is he going to be able to guard NBA power forwards? Is he going to be laterally quick enough to guard NBA threes? I'm not so concerned with Brandon Ingram on the offensive side of the floor as I am the defensive side of the floor. And look, that's something that gets overlooked, I think, time and time again, because the NBA has evolved into such a shot-making league. It's, you know, something that, you know, you have to look at with everybody. Well, they can do certain things offensively, but who are they guarding? If you want to talk about players in the NBA at the point guard position right now, and I know Simmons and Ingram aren't point guards, but just think about this right now. If they're going to be able to hold their own and keep their head above water in this league, they're going to have to guard Stephen Curry. They're going to have to guard Russell Westbrook. They are going to have to guard Damian Lillard. That is where the bar is in the NBA right now. And if you're looking right now at one or two, if it's Ben Simmons or Brandon Ingram, I just want to pose this question to you. If you flip-flop their rosters, would there be a debate? I don't think there would be. Wally Szczerbiak has been known to debate me on a number of topics. He's a Brandon Ingram guy. He was the sixth pick in the 1999 NBA draft. He is our guest coming up next. This is John Rothstein on the College Hoops Today podcast. Wally Szczerbiak was the sixth overall pick in the 1999 draft by the Minnesota Timberwolves. He played 10 years in the NBA, was an all-star, also made an appearance in the Western Conference Finals in 2004 with Minnesota, in the Eastern Conference Finals in 2009 with Cleveland, now working alongside myself and a host of others at CBS Sports and our college basketball coverage. You know, you can also see him on MSG as part of the Knicks pre- and post-game coverage. And Wally joins us now. And Wally, I spent the first portion of our podcast making the argument why Ben Simmons should be the number one pick in the 2016 NBA draft. I know that you were very, very adamant that you felt Brandon Ingram should be the top overall pick during the college basketball season. Have you wavered at all from that feeling?
Honestly, I haven't. If I had to pick and I was Philadelphia, I would take Brandon Ingram. I can definitely see why Simmons is so highly touted. My only questions with Simmons are in a game where shooting is becoming paramount. We're seeing it with Golden State Warriors. We're seeing a lot of the elite teams. He's a guy that is not a great outside shooter, and he was scared to shoot outside 15 feet. I made the reference to LeBron James. You know, when he trusts his jump shot and he's confident in his jump shot, he's unstoppable. And yes, if Ben Simmons gets that type of confidence in his jump shot and at least can keep the defense honest from the perimeter, he's going to be a tremendous pro because he's so tough to guard around the rim and he does so many other things. He's so skilled and he has so much vision.
Now, you mentioned LeBron James, and you were part of a team with LeBron that won 66 games in 2009, and you were one of those ancillary pieces around LeBron that gave him great spacing to operate because you were obviously a talented outside shooter. Ben Simmons didn't necessarily have that at LSU. Only one player on LSU shot over 40% from three this past season. That was Keith Hornsby. He only played 20 games. Duke had two of those players, and that's not counting Luke Kennard. If you flip-flop the supporting cast for Ben Simmons and Brandon Ingram, do you still think that you would feel the same way that Brandon Ingram should be the number one overall pick in the 2016 NBA draft?
You bring up a great point there. You really do. I think so. And here's why. Having been part of a team, you know, and different teams, Miami of Ohio, you know, obviously I was the go-to guy and I was the focal point of the offense, kind of like Ben Simmons. It's on your shoulders to win games. It's on your shoulders to make whatever play you need to make to get your team a win down the stretch of a game. In Brandon Ingram's case, he was maybe option 1B behind Grayson Allen. And I've been in that situation too in the pros when I was starting out with the Timberwolves with Kevin Garnett. And being option 1B, you don't get as many opportunities to really be the man, to take the big shots down the stretch of the games. You know, sometimes the offense goes away from you a little bit more than when the offense runs through you 100% of the time. So I think if Brandon Ingram was the first option on LSU, I think he would have put up better numbers than he did at Duke. I mean, I think he would have averaged 20-plus points. I'm not saying quite as good as Kevin Durant-type numbers when he was at Texas, but I think his numbers would have at least been a plus five in the points per game category, because he would have been the 1A option as opposed to the 1B. So my argument would still be the same if he was on LSU. Would they have made the tournament? Maybe not. You know, I think that LSU team was a little bit dysfunctional, but I think his numbers would have even been better than what they were at Duke, because he was playing alongside Grayson Allen.
You know, you think back to the year you were drafted, you were a veteran college player. Even when you look at the guy who was drafted, you know, number one overall in 99, Elton Brand was in college for 2 years. He went to an Elite Eight, he went to a national title game, and he was National Player of the Year. When you think right now about Simmons and Ingram in terms of being the number one overall pick, how much do you think we lose sight on the fact that these guys are going to be completely different in 3 or 4 years? Because really, right now, it's a rarity if we see multiple guys go at the top of the draft that have been in school for more than a season.
I completely agree, and that's why it's so tough on the general managers in the NBA. And they would love to see guys stay at least 2 years in college, but it's the other side of the coin, which is the Players Association that wants players' rights to allowed to get paid as early as possible. So that's the constant debate. I think we have a good system with the 1 year. I think you get to evaluate the guys for 1 year. In Brandon Ingram's case and in Ben Simmons' case, I think you see they're going to be very good pros. How much will they develop? You never know. There's a lot of expectations that come with being a number one pick in the draft and a number two pick in the draft. But from what I've seen from those guys, they're super talented. As long as they work on their craft day in and day out and they're pros about playing basketball and they keep themselves healthy. Keeping yourself healthy when you get to the pros is the number one most important thing, in my opinion. I struggled with that a little bit, and that's kind of what derailed my career, you know, after being an all-star in my third season. If they stay healthy, they're going to continue to improve, and they're going to be very good pros.
Now, you mentioned that being a pro, that's a term that a lot of professionals throw around. What's the biggest thing that you learned when you got to the NBA after a couple of seasons that you didn't know prior to being drafted?
That's a great question. You're in the real world now. I liken it to, you know, if you're part of a pack of dogs, and you know there's a little bit of there's a stack of meat, you know, in the middle of the whole group of dogs. You got to go in there and you got to fight for your piece, and that's what being in the pros is all about. There's no question, you know, there's a lucrative pot of gold at the end of the rainbow if you can get big contracts as a professional basketball player. So you got to be willing when you get on a team to fight for yourself individually. And obviously you want to be a great teammate. That's very important. You want to get to a great situation with a great coach and a great organization and a great owner. But you got to realize that if you slip up, there's going to be someone right behind you ready to take your piece of meat, you know, in that analogy with the pack of dogs, and take your spot, take your money, take your contract. So you got to have that attitude. You have got to have that mentality. Another thing you realize in the pros is, you know, when you're drafted by a team and, you know, obviously the coach is influential, the general manager is influential, they're investing a lot of their reputation in you as a player. They want you to succeed. You know, their job is on the line to make you succeed. So if you are not successful and you're not making them look good, you got to look at yourself. You got to point the finger at yourself in the mirror and say, what am I doing here to not be successful at this level? Because coming from college, a lot of people believed I would be successful at this level. My dad helped me out a lot with that. He played professionally in the ABA. He played overseas for 10 years. So he knew what it was about to be a pro. He knew what it was like when you didn't deliver for your organization or your franchise and the ramifications of that. So he helped me a lot out with that. And that's one thing I realized really quick. Being a professional, that you better bring it every single day, because there's a lot riding on how you play out there on that court.
You know, you mentioned that in terms of, you know, what people have invested in you, what general managers are going to have invested in you. And one of the things that I don't think people really pay attention to as much, because we're so focused on the players they were in college and what they might be, is the interview process. That's something, you know, we talk to a lot of executives, you know, you really see how much they value a person's character and what they are like in person. Tell us about what it was like to be interviewed by NBA teams before being a lottery pick in 99.
Well, I was in a unique situation because I knew I was going to be a top seven pick. So I interviewed with seven teams. I also did one individual workout up in Chicago where I invited anyone who wanted to come. They could be college coaches, NBA coaches. It was a completely open workout. I didn't want to hide anything. I worked out with my college assistant coach, James Whitford, who's now the coach at Ball State. He put me through an individual instruction workout for an hour that I used to do all throughout college that I did to prepare for the combines and for the workouts and for the pros. And it's a workout I still did when I was in the pros. So I showed well in that workout, showed my athleticism, showed, my shooting ability. But then individually, I went to seven teams. I went to the top seven draft picks because I was a pretty much locked to be a top seven pick. I flew into each team individually. I mentioned it yesterday on our show that our workouts involved two-on-two, one-on-one. They wanted to see me play against other guys at my position in the draft. So you had to have your hard hat on and be ready to compete. Competing against guys like James Posey, Ron Artest, Elton Brand, even at a workout in Chicago, we went one-on-one. So that's what the workouts were all about. Plus, you know, they'll take you out to eat. You know, they'll get to know you. I remember Jerry Krause in Chicago. They had the number one pick. He wanted to get to know me. I remember the Timberwolves, Rob Babcock, Kevin McHale, Flip Saunders all took me out to eat, wanted to get to know me, talk to me as a person, get to know me as a guy, get to, you know what my family was all about. So all that stuff is part of the interview process. You normally spend a whole day there. You fly in with each individual team and kind of get to know them, on both ends, on the court and off.
Now, this is just friend to friend right now, but if you're like at a nice steakhouse in Chicago with Jerry Krause, like, are you apprehensive to order appetizers or dessert? Or are you trying to keep it professional?
Because
you know me, I'd be going for a piece of carrot cake.
Yeah, you'd be racking up the bill. I know you. I just eat a good, healthy meal at that point in my career. I knew what nutrition was all about. You know, when you're playing as many minutes as we do at that time, and you're playing and getting as much exercise as we are and cardio and, training as hard as you are, you got to replenish that. So I was always a guy who, ate right, ate well. There was nothing wrong with a big steak and some, mashed potatoes and a good salad and, some asparagus. And then, if you keep the dessert to moderation and one piece of cake, there's nothing wrong with that. So I was never worried or concerned about what they thought about my eating habits. I had the reputation of having, 5% body fat, taking care of my body, and doing all the right things in college. And they had heard that, I think, coming in.
Wally Szczerbiak joining the College Hoops Today podcast with John Rothstein. Wally, obviously, a part of the college basketball coverage on CBS Sports. You can also see him on MSG doing pre- and post-game for the New York Knicks, breaking down the 2016 NBA draft. Wally, let's get to some other guys right now. And you had, and a lot of people as well, had been very high on Buddy Hield, and how can you not? Made 147 threes last year, really changed from his junior to his senior season in terms of his production level. But you know me, and we've differed about this, the last 5 or 6 years, I'm more of a defensive guy than, an offensive guy. When you look at Buddy Hield at 6'4", as potent as he is offensively, he's going to have to go into the NBA and guard wings. As somebody who has played the wing position and played it at a high level, how much of an adjustment is that going to be for Hield?
It's going to be an adjustment. I there's no question, but I always had the motto that you can teach a guy to play defense, you can teach a guy NBA rotations, you can teach him to be a great team defender, and all the notions of five guys on a string, think and fill, all the different terminology. You can teach a guy that, but you can't teach a guy to shoot, 50-plus percent from the three-point line and have 10, 12 games over 30 like he did this season at Oklahoma and score 46 at Fog Allen. So I'll take a guy who can, I'll draft a guy who has that offensive skill level of a Klay Thompson, of a Steph Curry, can shoot the basket, shoot the eyes out of the basketball with effortless, endless range. And I'll figure out how to make him work out there on the floor defensively. I think that's the job of the coaching staff. I think that's the job of his teammates, just to bring him along and teach him. He's a good athlete. He's a good kid. He's a willing learner. And there's no question in my mind that he'll fight and he'll compete on the defensive end of the floor. And that's what playing defense in the NBA is all about. And there's no question that, people thought I wasn't a great defender. But if you look at me as a team defender, I was always in the right spot. I used to take charges. if another team used to call an ISO, you know, against me, I took that challenge to stop that guy. I competed. I got after it in that one-on-one matchup, no matter who I was guarding, whether it was LeBron, Kobe, Carmelo. And then the other thing I tried to do, since I was a good offense player, was make them play defense. That's the biggest key. Mm-hmm. And I think we're seeing that, like, with Kyrie and Steph Curry. Steph Curry's a great offensive player. He's going at Kyrie. But at the same time, Kyrie's going back at Steph in these NBA finals. So that's one thing you got to realize as a player. And Buddy Hield's going to have to realize that no matter who you're playing against, if you're a starter off the bench, the guy can play that you're going against, but you got to make him work on the other end of the floor too.
You know, you've said that time and time again in our conversations through the years, that you were known for being a shooter, but not a lot of people don't always really take into account how hard it is to guard scores on the wing. Like, you've told me, you know, a million times about how hard it was to guard guys like Jamal Mashburn. Who were the toughest guys that you guarded as a pro?
The toughest guy was Paul Pierce. I couldn't figure out how to stop that guy. He was so silky smooth. I think it was because maybe he was a legit 6'7". So I always had a little bit of a height advantage over a lot of two guards, so I could use my length a little bit, space them a little bit, and, you know, always contest their jump shots and make them shoot over me. That was my motto defensively. My motto was, don't let them get by me and get a layup and break down the defense and get dribble penetration. If they put on, you know, a dribbling exhibition and knock down a 15-foot fadeaway over my hand on a step back, I'm going to live with that. But Paul Pierce, just his arsenal was incredible. He could post me up. He could run me off screens. His change of pace game was incredible. You know, you could never figure out what speed he was going. He doesn't look quick. He doesn't look fast. But he gets to where he wants to go, and he keeps you off balance. He's kind of like, you know, one of those old pitchers like Glavin, you know, from the Atlanta Braves, who just constantly kept his hitters off balance and they didn't know it was coming. He was probably by far the toughest for me to guard. You mentioned Jamal Mashburn. He was another guy that had height over me, so he could post me up. Those type of guys were tough. You know, obviously LeBron, when he came in the league, he was nobody can guard him, and I struggled with him too. So those are three guys, I think, because of their height and their strength, they were tough matchups for them.
All right. Well, we've seen the NBA shift into a type of game right now that you probably would love to play, because there's less physicality on defense and the hand check rule has really become obsolete. How much, in your opinion, does that go into making a decision on draft night? Because guys right now, like a Chris Dunn, like a DeJounte Murray, like a Jamal Murray, they're going to be viewed differently right now because they're going to have more freedom of movement. How much does the hand check rule play into that, in your opinion?
It definitely does. Along with the new analytics, the three-point shot's becoming a much bigger part of the game. You're seeing teams, you know, jack up 33s a night, because if you make 10 of them, that's like shooting 50% from the floor. And anytime you shoot 50% from the floor in the game, you're going to win a lot of basketball games as a percentage of the team. But, you know, the new rules, I think they're good for basketball. I think they're helping scoring. I think they're helping. I remember what it was like to play on offense, and you want to get into a flow. You want to get into a rhythm. You want to see the ball go through the basket. Because as a player, when you see the ball go through the basket, you know, not just a 20-point score, or for me, I was a 14-point scorer, even a guy who averages 5-10 points. You want to feel a part of the game on the offensive end of the floor. It helps you play better on defense. It helps you get more engaged mentally. I think it's just more fun for the fans to watch. And I think it's getting easier for the referees to referee, because they know if you touch a guy, it's a foul. And it's allowing, you know, the talent to show in the NBA players, because the NBA is the best players in the world. I think it's the greatest game in the world. And with the rules that the NBA is enacting, they're allowing those players to show that.
All right, I'm going to throw out right now, we're going to wrap this up. I'm going to throw out, I want to give all my nuggets away because we have a couple more shows to tape next week on CBS Sports Network, but I'm going to throw out my sleepers in the latter part of the first round. I'm going to give a little song and dance, and I want your reaction, and I'm going to go through a few in the second round, all right?
Yep.
Demetrius Jackson, I think, is the steal in the first round. Your thoughts, the kid from Notre Dame?
I agree. I think he could turn out to be better than Chris Dunn. I really do. I just think he's not as big, but he's as quick and as explosive, and I think he's shown a little bit more reliable jump shot from the outside. So I think he's in the Chris Dunn mold, and the fact that Chris Dunn's going to go 4-5, and you're going to get him late in the second round and the first round, I think he could definitely be a steal in the first round.
Another sleeper, I think this guy is the best two-way player in the draft that nobody's talking about, Patrick McCaw.
Listen, there was a lot of dysfunctionality out there in UNLV. Do you point it at the coaches? Do you point it at the players? They didn't really achieve a lot and be very successful. I'm just at the motto of if you're not a winner in college, it's going to be tough to be a winner in the NBA. Yes, he has a lot of talent, and he's very streaky, though. He's very skinny, though. I'm not as high on him as a guy like Demetrius Jackson, that's for sure.
All right, last first-round sleeper for me. I think he'll get drafted between 20 and 30 and have an impact on a team in the next couple of years. Torian Prince.
Love him. I absolutely love him. Love the statement he made about the rebound in the NCAA tournament. Has a great sense of humor, has a great head on his shoulders. I think he's super talented. He's super versatile. I think he could be like a Harrison Barnes. I really do. You know, Harrison Barnes was a 7th pick in the draft. I think he's in that same type of mold. If he gets into a team in a system like the Golden State Warriors with his ability to guard multiple positions, with his athleticism, with his playmaking ability, his shot-making ability, and his smarts and basketball IQ, I think he could be an absolute steal, and he could turn out to be like a Harrison Barnes.
All right, just say yay or nay on these 5 second-round, you know, picks I'm going to give you right now, just real quick. If you're buying, say yay. If you're not, say nay. Ready? The first one is going to be Kay Felder from Oakland.
Yay. I love the mid-major guys.
James Webb, Boise State.
Yay. Another mid-major guy that can rebound and stretch the floor, could play stretch 4 or the 3, I think, in the league.
The man that we call Inspector Gadget, Troy Williams from Indiana.
I'm going to say nay. Just too inconsistent. And over the course of 82 games, John, you got to bring it every single night. And he had too many inconsistent games with Indiana in a very, very fun system to play in. I'm going to say nay.
All right, final two right now. A guy who was a National Player of the Year candidate for about 3 or 4 months before tapering off, Jared Utah from Iowa.
Yay, for sure. I think he could be a great stretch 4, kind of like a Matt Bullard, kind of like a Steve Novak, someone like that, but with more skills and more to his game. You know, he had a great beginning of the season, and they fell off a little bit at the end, but I'm a big yay on him.
And then the final one, a guy who didn't get a chance to play in the postseason, but really reminds me of Danny Green. We don't know if he's going to go to a place like San Antonio. Damian Lee from Louisville.
I could see it. Yeah, I could see it. I don't think he's as good a shooter. And if you want to make it like Danny Green, you got to be a flat-out, cold-blooded assassin-type shooter. And does he have that ability? I don't know. That's going to be the big question mark for him, but I agree. Everything else, I think he's got those kind of tools to be that type of defender. But Danny Green is an elite, elite, elite shooter. And I don't know if Damian Lee quite is that good.
Wally, good hanging as always, man. I'll catch you next Monday in the studio. Thanks for making the time.
Sounds good. It was a lot of fun, John. Anytime.
You got it. Wally Szczerbiak, the number 6 pick of the 1999 NBA draft. This is the College Hoops Today podcast with John Rothstein. I'd like to thank Wally Szczerbiak for joining the College Hoops Today podcast. I want you to subscribe to the College Hoops Today podcast on iTunes. Leave us a review. Let us know what you think of the product we're bringing to you 52 weeks out of the calendar year. Also, check out the College Hoops Today fan page on Facebook. Give us a like, and also send me your questions right here on Twitter. I'm at John Rothstein. That's John, J-O-N. And the first question comes from Tide Hoops Blog, and it's, John, who are your projected NCAA tournament teams from the SEC? I got to tell you, right now, Kentucky, to me, is an absolute lock, obviously, and that's no surprise to be the number one team in that league. But I think the SEC right now, next year, looks like the Wildcats, and then everybody else. If you have to ask me who's number 2 in the SEC, I am going to say the Texas A&M Aggies. Next question comes from Mitchell. It's, John, what mid-major do you think will make noise this basketball season? Look, Gonzaga is not a mid-major in terms of the way they're perceived nationally, but I think Gonzaga is a top 15 team right now with the additions of Nigel Williams-Goss, the transfer from Washington, and John Williams III, the transfer from Missouri. But I'll tell you this, and this is something to keep your eyes on. Gonzaga is the favorite, per multiple sources, to land Cal transfer Jordan Matthews. He's visiting NC State this weekend. He will visit Gonzaga the following weekend. If Gonzaga can land Jordan Matthews, the transfer from Cal, to me, Mark Few's team rises up and becomes a potential top 10 team next season. Now time for some news and notes from around the world of college basketball. Speaking of Cal, the Bears landed Marcus Lee, the transfer from Kentucky, last Saturday. That was a spot-on match from the beginning. He will give, you know, Konzo Martin the type of replacement for Ivan Rabb that he needs to send the Bears to multiple NCAA tournaments. Some other news and notes from around now the NBA draft. I can tell you this about Cal swingman Jaylen Brown. According to multiple league sources, the three teams that have done the most research on Jaylen Brown are the Boston Celtics, the Phoenix Suns, and the Minnesota Timberwolves. Those teams pick 3, 4, and 5. Another interesting nugget, I talked to an NBA general manager. He told me that Dragan Bender, okay, will be better than any international prospect that we have seen the last couple of years, not named Kristaps Porzingis. That's some high praise right there for Bender. Jakob Poeltl, the center from Utah, from what I'm hearing, will likely won't slide past Milwaukee at 10, but because Bismack Biyombo opted out of his contract with Toronto, number 9 could be a possibility from the Austrian who played for Utah for the last 2 years. So that's something to keep an eye on for Jakob Poeltl. And another thing that's interesting, we have seen multiple reports on the NBA circuit on Chris Dunn and what he could do at the next level in the NBA. And we have also seen multiple reports regarding the 76ers potentially looking to add another top 5 pick and trading one of their big men. This much I can tell you. The Philadelphia 76ers absolutely love Chris Dunn. And if they acquire another top 5 pick, I am almost certain that he will be the target, because you look at that roster, that's the one glaring need. The Sixers need another dynamite breakdown guard. I'd like to thank Wally Zerbiak for joining the show. We will be back next week, same bat time, same bat channel, as we continue to get you set for the 2016 NBA draft. This was the College Hoops Today podcast with John Rothstein.